Well, I think my father rounded up, it cost him about $1 million Canadian to get me to the pros and to get me where I needed to go. It's not like football where you can get dropped off at a club. You need a parent to push you through it that's willing to believe in you enough and willing to risk everything.
Our guest today is this podcast's first former BBC Sports Personality of the Year winner. His professional tennis career spans 17 years from 91 to 2007. During that time, he won 15 career singles titles, highlighted by capturing the Paris Open title against Pete Sampras in 1998. He reached the US Open final, was British number one on multiple occasions. I'm not done yet. How about this for a flex? For a time, he held the record for fastest serve in the world at 149 miles per hour. Greg Rozetsky, welcome to More Than a Name.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me start with the BBC Sports Personality of the Year winner. Do you remember what you said when you won the trophy, first of all?
Yeah, I said something about SW19 and trying to win that one at the end, but that was in the last century. It was a long time ago. But it was a special time because everybody was saying, oh, you're going to win Sports Personality of the Year. And I didn't really at the time appreciate how big it was. And I was still focused on trying to finish the year as well as I could because I'd made the end of season finals, which a Brit hadn't done in the open era. So that was the major focus for me at the time. But what made it so special for myself personally was it was the British public who voted for you. So everybody knows my background. Grew up in Canada. My mom's English. That's why I have dual nationality and represented Britain. But to win that meant, okay, I felt like I'd finally become accepted from the British public, which at the beginning it was like, I'll never forget the newspaper headlines when in May that year of 1995, I turned pro. And I lost my first two matches at Queen's and Nottingham. Headline going into Wimbledon, he's definitely British. He can't win a match. This was the era before we had, you know, Henman show up, myself show up, then Andy Murray, Emma Raducanu. So back then we didn't have any real consistent world beaters who could possibly win majors yet.
Just going back to what you mentioned there about being accepted, was that a struggle for you?
Yeah, definitely. No question about it. I mean, listen to my accent. I'm still here. How many years later?
Did you let that affect you in the way you was playing? Did it have that kind of effect or not really?
Yeah, I think it did. I think I tried too hard at times. I think that's why I probably didn't have the results I'd like at Wimbledon. If you're confident, you're playing well, and you're healthy, I think it's a bonus. If you're struggling, not confident, it's a burden. It's hard enough being a British player playing Wimbledon, but imagine with that other dynamic. And I think for myself personally, 97 was a great year. Got to the quarterfinals. Henman was on the other side. If we both won, we were guaranteed a Brit in the finals. Both of us, unfortunately, didn't make it through. Then 98, I was the fourth player in the world, the fourth seed for the championships, tore ligaments in my ankles and broke part of my bone. So that was kind of the most disappointing. And then from there on in, it was a little bit of an uphill struggle. And I think when you're confident and when you have that belief, it's easier, but also the nationality thing at times can be a struggle, especially being accepted all the time, because back then the newspapers were a little bit more brutal than they are now.
What did they used to write about?
I remember one article, because I'm actually writing my autobiography right now myself.
Nice.
So I'm about 40,000 words into it. And I read one headline from the Daily Mail, and it said, "Oink, Canadian moose jaw." Something else like that.
Did I get away with stuff like that?
And basically, I was like, oh my God, how can, imagine if you said that today. And that was when I was actually playing well. So imagine if I was playing poorly. And you've got to remember, we had 7 papers to 12 papers daily. And you had, used to have the Sunday off at Wimbledon. And that Sunday off would be the press day. And the press always would be like they did with England football team. If you got semis or finals tournament, it's a hell of an event. I was playing Sampras my first year in 95, so I did the Sunday papers, and headlines is, Greg can beat Sampras. I was nowhere near the guy's level at that stage, and never have been, to be quite frank with you. But it's always too much pressure and not enough realism on those crazy headlines sometimes.
Did it feel like whatever you did, you were always going to be second behind Tim Henman?
At times, yes, but also it came down to results. So he was always better at Wimbledon than me. I mean, his record at Wimbledon's great. 4 quarterfinals, 4 semis. I was 1 quarters and I was always 4th round man. My big thing was when I got to the US Open finals in 97 and became the first Brit to crack top 10, then top 5, make the end of season championships. But Tim had that more consistency, and that grass court period was always the big time in Britain. They don't always follow the whole 10, 11 months of the year. And
no,
that's the
problem. In my family, Wimbledon would be on, but then we wouldn't really even get to see the footage of the US or the Australian and the French. You wouldn't, unless you was an avid tennis fan, Wimbledon was the thing you watched.
Yeah, it was. And also, ironically, when I got to that US Open Finals, this is when Sky first came on. So that was the biggest audience they had for tennis, which I think was 1.5 million at the time. But it's kind of that growth model now. And I think the benefit we have now is you have YouTube, you have all these other places where you can watch sport and figure out what you want to get. But back then, it's always been Wimbledon that month of the year.
What was the difference in support between you and Tim, especially at Wimbledon?
Well, I think support was great in the respect that I think whoever's winning and whoever's doing better is going to get the support. And I think after 97 and when I got to the US Open Finals, that was what I called the acceptance. But I think the problem I had, and I didn't do as well, as A, injury, and B, expectation. A word that I think most athletes, if they go process more than expectation, become more successful because, oh, I'm expected to win. I should do this. I could do this, and I'm going to focus on what I can control. And when you lose focus and put too much pressure, expectation on yourself going into Wimbledon, and you don't manage it correctly, that's usually when you fail.
It's just interesting you talked about media there. Like, I'm imagining if you won Wimbledon, Tim Henman won Wimbledon, what the difference in reaction would be?
I don't think there would be a huge
difference. You think it would be the same?
Yeah, I think it would be the same because if you win, everybody loves a winner. Mm. And it was, 77 years before Murray won Wimbledon as a male tennis player. We had Virginia Wade, who'd won it in the Queen's Jubilee year. Was it silver? I think it was silver.
I think it was silver.
Silver, yes. Now, Jubilee, I'm going a little bit too far ahead. So I think if you win, the reaction is going to be great because everybody loves to celebrate. Everybody loves a party.
You're 100% British then if you'd have won that, wouldn't you? It's like, yeah, we know all along. Of course he is.
Yeah, and the other thing is the world right now is so multicultural, so diverse, and there's so many people in every single country this year. It's a different time in our lives than if we go back to the last century.
The change from Canada to Britain.
Yeah.
What was the story behind that, the reason
behind that? Well, it was really an easy decision. My girlfriend, who's my wife now, was living there. I was spending a lot of time in the UK. My mum was born in Yorkshire in Dewsbury. I was named after my grandfather, who never wanted to leave. That's the irony of the story. And I think, you know, coming to a nation where you have a slam and then also to have the facilities and the support, it was almost a no-brainer for me. And I've still been here 30 years later, so I must like the country as well.
So, guys, what's more lonely, football or tennis? As a profession?
Well, I don't know, but I'm guessing tennis.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, football, at least you must have some friends in the locker room.
The only thing I would say is I would always, I think, prefer to have played an individual sport because it's more measurable. So if I go out there and I play well, I'm going to win. If I lose, it's my fault. I can take that. I think as a footballer, sometimes you can play well, miss a couple of chances at the other end, or your goalie throws one in and you lose a game. But it's not measurable to how you played, and you can find yourself out of a team, or you can even get carried if you don't play well. But I think I would have enjoyed it all being on me and me digging in and making sure that the only thing I would say, once you start losing a few, it can be, I'm pretty sure, pretty lonely when you're traveling around the world on your own.
I think the environment now for the pro players in tennis is much more amicable. They go out for meals more often. They spend more time together. There's more money. I was laughing with Krajicek. He said, when I won Wimbledon in 96, I got £320,000. Nowadays, £3.5 million. So it's a 10-to-1 ratio, which is quite incredible. So that allows you to carry more physios, more coaches, more family members. It just allows it to make it a lot easier than during my generation. Our role model was Sampras. He was a little bit more of a recluse. He would kept himself to himself. So you always look at what the number one of your generation is doing. You copy that. And I think one of the mistakes I should have been more social with all the other players around. The reason I think footballer is easier because you're traveling with a team all the time. You've always got someone on the team you're going to relate to and you can talk about your problems and you're all in a group effort to achieve. I'm not going to say it to my biggest rival, I'm really feeling bad today. Knees a little bit sore. You're kind of always having that game face. And I think that's where football in one respect is easier. And I think also, you know, when you sign a contract, you're usually with that team for that period of time as well. So there's few nuances that are a little bit easier. But you're right. I have friends of mine who are footballers and they can play terribly. The team wins. They can have their best match of their career and they can lose.
One of our producers made a good point, Will, about back in the day, at least when you were playing, Greg, communication technology was obviously a little bit different to what it is now.
Yeah.
So traveling that much, how did you stay in contact with people?
Well, I started in 1991. I had not a penny in my pocket. I had multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay back because obviously it was in Canadian dollars. And so I bought my girlfriend a fax machine because cheapest way, long distance calls back then were super expensive. It's not like nowadays, you put a SIM card in, it's £12 for the month and you can call anywhere in the world. Back then it was basically 12 quid a minute. So you were trying to save any money to put to your flights because flights were expensive. There wasn't cheap travel. You had to find the cheapest accommodation. Then you had to pay a coach. Then you had to pay their salary. So you're having to do all those things independently. So fax machine to start. Then mobile phones came into play. And that was a savior. Honestly, that made my life so much easier. And now you can FaceTime and see your family and friends.
You weren't writing letters though.
I did write some letters as well in the post as well.
Depending how long you stayed in the toilet.
Well, exactly. So for example, if I posted it, it would probably arrive by the time I got home if I had a really bad event.
Oh, that's funny. But
God, that makes me feel old.
Fax machines. I don't even know what they look like. Did tennis find you or did you find tennis?
I think it was a combination of two. My dad always wanted to be a professional tennis player, but obviously with the surname, which is Rozetsky, it's Ukrainian Russian background. So he emigrated to Canada. So did my mom from the UK. And they met. And my grandfather worked on the docks. My grandmother worked as a cleaning lady. For them, education was the key to success. Also, growing up in Canada, 6 months of the year, you'd have to be in indoor courts. That's not cheap. And they just didn't have the finance. Anybody who says becoming a professional tennis player is affordable is talking to a load of rubbish. It is an expensive sport to do. The only way to make it is you find a great sponsor. You have a wealthy family, you have a wealthy federation, you find a way with sponsors or some sort of solution. So my father never had the affordability to be able to do it. Then he had two sons and he gave us the opportunity, started in a local park, had a really, really good thing with good fortune because at the time the tennis coach in the local park came up to my dad and said, "Do you want to give your son some lessons? I think he's got something." My dad's like, "Okay. You know, what do you think he has?" Well, he can throw a ball well, which means he can have a good serve because growing up in North America, they play baseball, they play American football instead of cricket. So it's real, really good throwing motion. She could see I had good focus. And so my father was in quality control working for the railroad. So he likes to ask a lot of questions. He says, "Well, how do you see all this? Are you trying to game me to get some private lessons with my kids or put them in a group? What's going on?" And she explained her son was one of the best under 10 players in the world, which coming from Canada at the time is a really unusual thing. And so she said, "Look, my son is beating the Americans." At that generation, the Americans were the gold standard. They had McEnroe, they had Connors, they had Martina Navratilova, they had Chrissy Everett, all number ones, best juniors in the world. And this young Canadian kid who was under 10 was beating Sampras, Agassi, Courier at that age group, which was unheard of. And we know what those guys, three guys did. The other guy didn't turn up too much because he enjoyed the party lifestyle a little bit too much. But that happened to have that little bit of luck with my dad wanting to be a tennis player and then meeting the right coach in a local park that actually propelled me into that direction.
What were your outgoings, Luke, in football?
Yeah, hardly anything. And back in my day, most of the time you was playing out, you know, on your green outside your house. And that's where you learned your trade, really, was on the estate. Obviously, you had minimal subs to pay if you was playing for your Sunday team. Not a lot at all. So yeah, the cost of a football and enough players to have a kick around, really. So not a lot at all, other than your parents, you know, once you start getting into bigger teams and you've got to maybe like to get to Tottenham twice a week, it's just your petrol money and your parents' time.
That's where tennis is so much more difficult. And also the coach says to your parents, if they don't want them around, come on, leave them off and get on with it. Yeah. This is a full investment because the parents have to take you to tournaments on the weekends. They have to take you to group lessons. Then you have to get a physical trainer. You have to get anything. So from a young age, your parents are running the business. And if you look at 99 of the top 100 players in the men's or the women's game have to have a parent who's really getting stuck in, obsessed with it, just as much as the child, as well as trying to find financial means, because you got to pay for indoor courts. You got to pay for coaching. You got to pay for all these things. It's not funded through a squad or a community project.
Do you know when you said earlier about you got to try and find a sponsor?
Yep.
Could that also be like an agent that then funds that for you? But then is it heavily in their favor if you
Well, it is heavily in their favor, and then you have to pay the money back. So in my case, my father mortgaged the house to Hilt 3 times. And on top of doing that, then I wrote letters to sponsors where they would fund me money. Then I had certain sponsors I had to pay back money and a certain percentage as well of future earnings. So it was all those things, because I was not grown up with a tennis court in my backyard like some players, having the parents who could afford it or a wealthy tennis federation. So this was a huge risk. And we're like, okay, I have a cutoff date. If I don't make it by the time I'm 21, time to go back to school, declare bankruptcy, and let's get on to life.
Did you know that your dad was mortgaging the house as well? So yeah, the pressure on you was like immense.
Well, I knew it was there, but my father was very good at trying to keep me away from that. Mm. So what he did is, you know what's going on, but you kind of don't think about it. I think when it goes wrong is when you're feeling that excessive pressure and you can't perform. And because it was a passion, something I wanted to do, it wasn't like, you know, some parents want it more for the kids than for themselves. It hasn't gone wrong after I've retired, because sometimes it goes wrong for some great players who've achieved a lot of good things because it not necessarily was their choice.
What's the average cost then? What were you spending in those early years before you turned pro?
Well, I think my father rounded up, it cost him about $1 million Canadian to get me to the pros and to get me where I needed to go. So if you took it this generation, it probably costs between 50-100 grand a year. So that's some serious money that needs to be backed if you're going to do it professionally. The nice thing for the pros now is with the increase of prize money, if you get into 4 majors, you're up to nearly $400,000 US, so about, I don't know, about £300,000 a year. So that's the positive when you get there. In my generation, you weren't getting anywhere near that money. You'd have to be higher ranking to cover some of your costs from the 4 majors.
Did you pay him back immediately?
I had to pay back the sponsors first to start off with, and then after that, sorted out the rest. So fortunately for me, the career went okay.
Because football and tennis has changed so much since you were both playing professionally. Technology, analytics, the way we coach, the way we eat, everything. How have you noticed it both in your sport?
I think the physicality, and I think players are quicker now, stronger. I think that they play more games than we used to per season. So as athletes, they're becoming more robust as well.
Are there too many games?
I would believe so, because you're expecting these players to go out there and perform to their best. And I mentioned to you before, look, when the crowd are there watching, they don't know that half the team that's going out there are carrying a little bit of a niggle here, a niggle there.
During my generation, after 30 was considered bonus time. So if you made 30, like 30, 31, you're thinking, okay, 32, maybe I'm going to retire around that age. Look at Novak, 39 years of age, third best player on the planet, even though he's fourth. Because you got cryo now, which is basically you go in for 3 minutes and 100, minus 100, you recover quicker. You have the basic oxygen, so you can go get the oxygen tents, you can go sleep in to get more red blood cells naturally in the body. Then you have the game ready, you know, which you put on your legs to recover, compress and get the ice quicker. So I think the sports science, and you talk about nutrition as well, the nutrition is so much better. You can take blood tests, what you're allergic to, what maximizes your potential, which to me, the GOAT is Novak, because he is maximized in all those areas now. And I think the coaching, the data, all those things add another texture to it, but it's also what they've done to the courts. Like tennis now has become medium slow on all surfaces. The balls are heavier and fluffier, so you have to be physically stronger. You have to hit everything hard, and you can't really have any weaknesses in your game. So those combination have made it better. Do I think the legends or greats of the previous generation would have been as good as this? Yes, I do, because they would have used what we have now to make themselves as great as the greats are now.
But the tech in tennis, the perception of it from the fans is totally different to football. Like, it feels like tennis leads the way.
Well, if you're talking technology from like Hawkeye, I think that's great. I think we would have never had those big arguments. Like John McEnroe's made a career out of you cannot be serious. Chalk flew up on the line. You won't have those mistakes with technology. And sometimes the mistakes are what brings the fan because it creates tension, it creates argument. And I think that's why football sometimes struggled with VAR because it stop-starts the game sometimes a little bit too much.
Football's never had that. It's never been a stop-start game. And now fans are getting frustrated in the crowd when a goal goes in, then it gets chalked off. But they don't quite know why it's been chalked off. So the fans are frustrated. A player will score and he doesn't know whether he can run off and celebrate or he can't. And the manager's thinking, well, they're doing a check. I don't know what it's on. And before you know it, you're 3 minutes in and you don't know whether you scored or not.
And the other thing is you can use it as a momentum killer. And so that's the thing is, I mean, with tennis, with Hawkeye, it's pretty quick and it's to the point. And then the other thing is we've got a lot of analytics in our game where you have Tennis IQ, which is free on the ATP Tour. They're trying to get it on the WTA Tour as well, which shows you patterns of where people like to serve, where they like to return. But there's still that natural instinct that comes in and still some of the, you have to feel it because you're dealing with fractions of seconds.
Yeah, so you know when that kind of stat thing you mentioned there, so you know, back in your day, have you got to have a coach that says, right, listen, on his second serve, he generally likes to do this, but there's no real stats behind it. You're just watching how they play.
Well, you'd watch a lot of tennis on the TV and you hope you hired the right coach. Because if he gets it wrong, you're sure going to get a barrage about it. But you see, the other thing with all this data, the great players will know the other guy knows that. So you've got the double bluff coming as well. So you can have all the data, you can have all the technology, but it still comes to instinct, feel, and reading the situation. Like Roger Federer, they did an interview with him and they talked about this exact situation. And he says, yeah, my coach, Ivan Ljubicic, he gives me all the data, looks on Niels, but then I get going and then I just let it flow because it's there subconsciously of what he needs to do. Mm. And he can feel it. And, you know, you look at it, when you take a penalty, you have the time. It's like serving. But, you know, the keeper, it comes down to so many different aspects. It's the psychology of it. You know, do I take, you know, Shearer, I believe it was always top left corner. The keeper knew it was going there, but he couldn't stop it because it was struck so well. So there's still those sorts of plays as well.
Your serve.
Yep.
When did it become a weapon for you?
I think right from the start, because when I was 9, I used to pitch baseball, but I was really bored in the team atmosphere because the coach could take you out anytime. He could just say, that's enough, come on out, go into the outfield, go play. And what I loved about tennis was that I was in control, I could do it, and I always had a fast arm. If you have a fast arm, there's no reason a coach can't give you a good serve, in my opinion. And so that was one of my strengths from the beginning. As I talked that previous story as a 6-year-old with my first local coach in the park, she basically said to me, look, you can throw a ball well and you got a fast arm. So let's maximize
She wasn't
that.
Even playing tennis when she's noticed this. What
yeah,
are you doing?
I was just throwing the ball around. I was a 6-year-old throwing the ball around.
Crazy.
So she was just seeing, you need to be hyper-focused as a tennis player. So like arm, one set or two sets, there's only one or two points you have to win it. But if you're not turned on there, you're going to lose. And if you have a good arm, if you get a semi-decent coach who knows what they're doing, they should be able to give you an absolute cannon. Serve and return are two of the most important shots in our game. And if you don't have those to world standard with the rest, forget about it.
Your record serve was 149 miles per hour.
New technology over 150, I would say.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was told that by the people who do Hawkeye. but not as fast as Andy Ruddick, who beat it. For sure, he was quicker than me. And then John Isner, who was 6'10". I couldn't compete with that.
Did you want to break the record? How did it make you feel when you did?
It was quite funny. I remember it to this day. I was in Indian Wells, 1998. I know, let's go back to the last century. He's old. And I was playing Thomas Muster. And I broke the record for the second time. Because I had in the beginning of the year at 137. I hit 143 down the tee and he hit a backhand winner. So I didn't even realize that I'd broken the record originally. And it felt really bad that the guy's just taken my world record and made it look like an absolute bunny return. Then the second time, I got up to 149 down the tee and hit an ace. And I heard this big eruption. And then I knew I had the record at that stage. And that was pretty special because the fact that I hit the serve exactly where I wanted. It came out like a rocket and I knew I got the record. So it was mixed feelings and you know, the first time breaking it, but the second time was quite special. But everybody was hoping for that 150 barrier, which I never got to. The only time you're 100% in control is when you serve. So that's the only time you're the boss. And the rest of the time, you're reacting. But if you serve well and it's not read, then you take control of it. And you have to have great anticipation. You have to have great strategy.
Right now, at the top of the men's game, you have Carlos Alcaraz, Jannik Sinner, and then the rest. Back in 1997, you reached a career high ranking of, well, number four.
Yep.
Who were the comparisons back in your day? And did you just think, I can't quite get to that level?
No, my ego said I could. My tennis didn't. I mean, just Sampras was just more complete. He had more game. He was a phenom winning the US Open as a 19-year-old. We had Courier, who was a grinder, number one, a maximizer, just brutal baseliner. Then you had guys like Rafter come in. There's, you know, Cervalli, who I lost to in the US Open finals, who was slightly better. But you have to have that belief that you can get there. I actually was not too far away from getting to one in the world. I had a week in Miami where I lost to Rios the week before in Indian Wells in the finals. That match was for three in the world. Whoever won Miami, Rios, myself, Rafter, Korda would be the new world number one. And unfortunately, I lost in the fourth round to Inquist. Remember the match precisely because that was the goal that week. And Rios won the Sunshine Double to be the number one player in the world and the only number one in our sport who never won a major as world number one. If you don't reach for the stars.
What was the difference?
The difference is my backhand wasn't good enough. So that was a little bit of a glaring weakness, which was more mental than physiological. And I think staying healthy throughout. So I had great momentum in 97, getting the US Open finals. Got injured going into the championships in 98, which set me back on one foot. And I just kept on getting injured back forth and wasn't good enough to make those changes I needed in my game and wasn't willing to take enough risks. I said it in my own podcast today because I actually had this discussion where I said I was a little bit too rigid and I wanted everything structured in a box. If you look at the greats, they're a little bit more flexible of mind and willing to take certain other risks to make themselves complete. Like right now, you cannot have any sort of weakness in your game. I mean, you look at Sinner Alcaraz, where's the weakness?
Did you find other players play towards your backhand?
Yeah, I felt they played towards my backhand, but I could neutralize it with my slice, which is keeping the ball low, to get my forehand into play to do it rip. And I knew where the ball was coming on all the big points. So sometimes they would play me into form, and I would only need to make one at the big moment. So even though it was a weakness, on a quick to medium court, I could get away with it. On a slow court, I couldn't because they could punish me more. And where the game is at now, the thing is, it's medium and slow and everything's slow. So you cannot afford to have that sort of weakness because you can get away with your hands, you can get away with other things and learn how to manage it. But because the way the game is now, you can't do that.
Take us back to that US Open final then, 97, Pat Rafter. What do you remember about that day? Not tactically, but emotionally.
Let me give you a little bit of context about that. So it was the first year they had Arthur Ashe Stadium. First year of the Billie Jean King Center. I'd never won a match in New York. I was 0-6 going into the tournament. My preparation was perfect. Everything was new. First week, I fly by the first week. You know, they say you can lose a slam in the first week if you have too many long matches. So I won my opening three matches, just crunching everybody, not dropping a set. Then the Sunday, I get back from practice before my Monday fourth round match, turn on TV. There was a car crash in Paris and Princess Diana was in that big accident. I watched for hours on end thinking to myself, okay, this doesn't look good, but I got to turn off the TV. As a sportsman or sportswoman, you know, psychologically, you've got to get that sleep, that rest, recovery for your match, but it didn't look good. Woke up the next morning, turned on the TV, sad news, she passed away. Terrible, terrible time for the country. I remember all the flowers at Kensington Palace, everything that was going on in the country, and all sport in the whole country was canceled. So there was not a sportswoman, sportsman, in all of Britain playing any sport whatsoever. My agent calls me up and says, Greg, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to continue playing? What's going to happen there? And I say, there's no question I'm going to keep playing. I've worked 18 years to get to this stage. You know, we're deciding to wear a black ribbon on my shirt to commemorate her. You know, the press wants to know how you're feeling. At the time, I felt deep sadness for her family, especially her two boys losing a mother. Get on court, win again. Then I play the Wimbledon champion of the year previous, Krejcik, in the quarters. Win that one to make my first semis, winning straight. So I haven't dropped a set at all throughout the tournament. Next morning, I wake up, sore throat, really feeling not well. Go find a nose throat specialist. Nice thing is I had 2 days off because back then it was Super Saturday and then you play the finals on Sunday, which doesn't happen anymore. So now it's Friday, day off, finals. play Jonas Bjorkman, a Swede who's playing great tennis of his life. He's knocked out Sampras and I think Korda to make it into the semis, winning record against me. But he is so tight walking on that stadium because he's thinking, oh, I can beat this guy easily, no question about it. He's so, so nervous. So I pounce early, win a 5-set epic in the final set, which is probably my highlight of my US Open. And then the next day I have to bounce back for the finals against Rafter. So I had a doctor on my team. You know about the TUEs, which are the therapeutical use exemptions you get as players. I was so sick, I was offered a steroid to play in the finals. I turned it down because I thought it was cheating, even though you're allowed to do that. So walking out there, I've got the excitement, thinking, okay, I'm getting adrenaline's going to get me through. A little bit of a windy day. Rafter's taking my serve early, not hitting my spots, playing a great match. Wins the opening 2 sets, bounce back in the third, get a little tired in the fourth. He pounces. 7-5 Rafter, thinking to myself, okay, made my first slam final, many more to come. But unfortunately for me, it never happened again. And there's always that one question mark in the head. What if, what could have happened if I would have taken that? Would I have won? Maybe. Would I have lost? Maybe. But I'll never know the answer. And that to me is the one match in my whole career. I think, what if I would have taken the TUE? Would it have given me the energy? And then I wouldn't have questioned that match as much in my mind.
What do you think you would have done in that situation?
I think I probably would have done the same as Greg, to be honest with you. But the 5 sets and the semi, I'm guessing, didn't help your energy levels either, especially if you're not feeling under the weather. But I don't know. Do you still feel like you'd make the same decision now?
No. This is where I think to myself, you need a strong team. So like I had a really good doctor who looked after me and the doctor had gone there specifically to get that because she was worried about me getting, being ill or too tired to take the opportunity. And nobody in my team stood up to me and said, no, this opportunity might never come to you again. Let's grasp it. There's many greats of the game who've taken TUEs. So you can name a list of all the great champions that have done so in finals of slams, have done so at other events to come through because they're sick or something happened to. So it's actually something that is legal to do. So that to me is where the people around you've got to remind you, oh, you're on a tear, you just turned 24 years of age, you're in your first major final. This might not happen again. You've got to grasp it. And for me, that's where I wish my team would have said, no, you take that, you get on with it.
Was you 100% sure? Was there a question mark?
No, there wasn't at my time. It was young naivety and not having the experience of a team. I had a coach who'd won a major, won the Australian Open. And I just felt like if that happened to me with a player I'm working with or coaching, I would say, this is your opportunity right now. You might never have this happen again. You could get injured. You could be that. You have to seize that moment and opportunity because getting to a Grand Slam final is an accomplishment, but winning is different gravy. It's like you're playing for England. It's the World Cup final, okay, and you got to play your position. And you know for those 90 minutes, you need to be the best you can because the other guy across from you is going to be the best they are going to be. So imagine England, Germany in the finals, and you're allowed to take something legal because of your illness. Would you do it? And there's no question. I thought I'd get through with adrenaline. Right. And I'd played Rafter. I played Rafter 3 weeks before and lost him in a tight 3-set match in New Haven. So I kind of knew that idea. And that's the only match I question. When I lost to Rios and Indian Wells, which was another big tournament, I just said, too frigging good, mate. You were just unbelievable. You were by far the better player. And on that day, if I could have pushed it into a 5th set, I might have still lost, but I just wouldn't have that question in my mind. And we only got one life.
What did your inner voice say after big losses?
That one, it just said, let's get on to the next tournament. This is the upswing. And I didn't know what was going to happen. What happens to you the older you get when you lose tough matches? Something called scar tissue in the brain. So what ends up happening is you start doubting yourself at big moments. When you're young and dumb, as I like to say, you don't fear those things. And then you get more analytical. And that's where with your team, you have to practice those scenarios. That's where a sports psychologist comes in to help you, the right sports psychologist, because they have to understand sport and get you over those hurdles and those hump, because everybody goes through it in sport, no matter how good you are.
Did you work with a sports psychologist?
I did from 11. So my father, the reason at times it was so expensive was he always believed in hiring the best people. I had a sports psychologist at 11. I had a physical trainer at 13, like the modern people did. So my father ran this as a business with trying to get good people around me. That was in the 1980s. People weren't doing that.
What were you talking about at 11?
Well, visualization, positive self-talk, body language, putting my best tennis to video. So when you walk on court and the music's playing, you're seeing yourself doing it. So all those little things. And the older I got, I didn't use it quite as much. And I wish at stages where I had surgeries or difficulties, I would have brought somebody in to help me during those periods.
Do you ever wish, Luke, you'd have had that support during your career? Remember when James Haskell came in and he said, I was doing therapy from 15, 16 as well. I think because of his dad too.
Yeah, I think different sports. So an individual sport like tennis, I think it's more valuable than maybe in a team sport like myself. I didn't really feel like the necessity to do it, and nobody else was doing it around about my time. I think your dad's probably ahead of the game there with bringing someone in like that.
Well, I think my dad realized the pressure and expectation that was going to be put on me because it was an individual sport. And I was lucky because in my neighborhood was the sports psychologist who worked with Team Canada ice hockey team. He just happened to be in the neighborhood. My dad thought, oh, this will be a good fit. And they were winning. They were number one team in the world. They were winning gold medals. Tennis was considered a really tiny sport, non-existent. That was a social game. That wasn't really as considered a sport back then where I grew up. So to have the luck with the people around you to put into place and then a parent who was willing to do whatever it took was, as I call it, a dangerous combination to try to succeed.
You said the right sports psychologist. Did you ever work with someone, we don't have to name names here, Greg, but did you ever have the wrong person with you?
No, I don't think I had the wrong person, but like one person I searched out who I think is absolutely brilliant is Dr. Steve Peters. So when I retired in 07, I went to go meet him because I'll read an article in the newspaper and I'll say, oh, that's interesting. Let me call them to see if I can have a meeting.
He wrote The Chimp Paradox.
Yeah, he wrote The Chimp Paradox and he does brilliant work. So I like the way he thinks and, you know, all the success he's had with British cycling to working in football and other sports. And he's got a systematic approach and his theory, the way it works. So it's always searching out the right person that understands the mind, understands sport. And I think sometimes people who've played at a high level as well can help as well. But I think he's done an amazing job. He's a great example. But I wouldn't say somebody who just understands the psychology of it but doesn't understand the sport and get that mixture with it.
You reached out to him after retirement?
Yeah.
What for?
Well, I was just fascinated. I was fascinated his work he did with Ronnie O'Sullivan, which he's talked about. I was fascinated by his work with Chris Hoy and Victoria Pendleton. I'm always trying to learn. So when I work, I've worked with Victoria Azarenka, former world number one tennis player. I've worked with a lot of the British juniors coming up. We won the Junior Davis Cup years ago, performance. So I want to understand why certain people achieve, what processes we can use to make them better on court, off court, what language is needed, so many different factors. So it's continually being educated in other ways. And not only does it help you in sport, it helps you in life.
The pressures of Wimbledon particularly. Could you tell us exactly what it was like for you to play there and the elements of that work with the psychologist that you took into the grass season here?
Well, I think for going into the grass season, you've got to find a way to reduce the expectation, get through. I always found the most difficult match was always the first round. Because once you get the first round through, you get the momentum going. And I think you've got to see yourself. Like I was very, very, I wrote a lot about what I wanted to do tactically. I discussed it with my coach the night before so I could visualize seeing what I wanted to do. The older I got, I didn't use those techniques enough when injuries and scar tissue happened. But from 95, 96, 97, 98, 99, I did a lot of that work, but I knew what I needed to do. And that's what, from a young age at 11, I learned the visualization. I learned how to scout. I learned how to put the processes into play. I learned how to rate my practice sessions, what areas I needed to improve. So I had a full game plan of how I wanted to achieve things. And that's what I try to do when I coach or work with somebody. So try to get better every day. Know what your strengths are, know what your weaknesses are, and know how you win. Because a lot of people will say train or practice, but they don't know why. Why am I doing this? Oh, because the coach tells me. That's not good enough. You got to know why you're winning, why you're training, why you're doing something, and what is your goal you're trying to achieve. And I think not enough people have that sort of formula in their brains. And you have to have this insatiable hunger and drive to to want to win. If you don't and you get a little lazy or you get a little nonchalant about it, it goes away pretty quickly because there's always somebody hungrier behind you. And we're on a 52-week cycle. We haven't signed a 5-year contract saying, you know, we get X, Y, and Z. So if you don't do the same or better, there's only one way you go backwards, and everybody's trying to get better at the time. So it's like a little bit of a race to the top.
Because you're contracted, Luke, right? It's completely different.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of security there in football. You get a 4-year deal and you're on the same money, you know, regardless of your performance. But obviously, when you're winning games as a team, it's better for everyone. But I think as an individual like you, when you're playing tennis, you're getting paid to perform well. And if you're not performing well, you're not getting any money whatsoever, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I was laughing. So I was, I had my first foot surgery, and I had a really interesting crew. So Dr. Müller Wohlfahrt, the famous German doctor for the national team, I had my surgery in Munich, and then he had the physio for the German national team, this guy Klaus Eder, who was in Regensburg in a small town. And not only did I have surgery, Sebastian Deisler played for Bayern Munich, did, and Haile Gebrselassie, the Olympic champion. So there's three of us there in the middle of nowhere, 100,000 village, for this guy's physiotherapy rehab center to get us all back into shape. And I'm sitting there, and he's watching Bayern Munich on the TV. Oh, just made a bonus because he's not playing. So like if the team wins or they keep on going through and making bonus. So Haile and myself are like, I have it tough as a tennis player, but an Olympian has it even tougher because they've got to win the gold medal. They've got to be number one. So there's always swings and roundabout. And when you're self-employed, you're your own boss, which is a positive. But also if you're not playing or you're not producing, everything goes backwards. And all your contracts for most people, with a few exceptions, is all tied by where your world ranking is as well. So that was a great experience to have three different personalities culturally, sport-wise, and even though it was a difficult time with the physio and all the work we were doing daily, it was an interesting time to talk about life, cultures, and how their sport works.
You talked there about having people around you. So what did you personally need from your family, from your support group?
I think you need stability. So that is huge. So everybody has a role to play. Your personal life has to be in good shape because that affects your performance. So, you know, I was lucky that my wife now and my girlfriend at the time was very supportive, had her dreams and ambitions. So that was important part, was personal life was in good check. I would say having a group of people who are on the same page and are very good at communicating with each other. That's what my father did when I was younger. So he managed that team. And then when I got older and became professional, I would have to manage the team. The physical trainer needs to speak with the sports psychologist and the coach to make sure they're all in link with the daily program to train. So you got to make sure you do X amount of hours on the court. If you're doing more hours on the tennis court, your physical work goes down a little bit. If you're doing less hours on the court, your physical off-court stuff goes up. Your nutritionist, your sports psychologist, what to look through, how are the rituals working that you've worked with your sports psychologist. I was the first person to create the towel to slow myself down. So, you know, all those people get annoyed from the player taking the towel is me.
Really?
Yes.
Sorry, can you go into that a little bit more? Is that instinct? Or?
No, that was an intentional. So I would play too fast. And to slow myself down, I would grab the towel as a ritual to slow myself down to get more composed, to be ready to serve. So sometimes I would grab it just to slow the speed down of play so I wouldn't rush through something too quickly. So it's about momentum and control and speed. So that was the ritual. So I'm known as the towel guy who basically, whenever you see a player grab a towel at the side of court, I'm to blame for that.
Anything else? Sorry, I cut you off there.
No problem. I think I'll give you an example of one story. So I just turned pro 1991, great place to go. I thought I'd go to Israel during the Gulf War, easy points. Going to be no problem, getting through that. I'm going to jump. I was top 10 junior in the world. I was already 600 in the men's game. This should be easy. On that period, you have to play in Israel for a month. To get your points, you have to do well enough in the 3 weeks to get the final week. So I'm just turned pro, just signed my first contracts with Nike, Wilson. Here I go, got to make some money, pay back people who believed in me. I lose first round in singles, first round in doubles. Great start to local Israeli boys. Fantastic. You're in top 10 juniors in the world. You can't even beat the locals at the lowest level professional tournament. So I get on the phone, which is long distance. I call my dad. I say, call me back. I want to come home. And so my dad said, no, wait half an hour. We're going to call you back, the whole team. It's not just going to be my dad on the phone. It was going to be my psychologist, my physical trainer, my coach, and my dad on the phone. So all four of them get together in the room and say, look, this is a hiccup. Don't worry about it. Our advice to you is go to the beach tomorrow. Well, I was in Haifa in Israel, and they said, think about all the work you've put in the last, what is it, probably I was 18 at the time. So that means I started when I was six. So I'd put in a total of 12 years. Think of all the hard work you've put in. Yes, this is a hiccup. You've put too much pressure, expectation. You want to do well. You feel you should win these things. Go to beach, take a day off, go back to training. But if you want to come home, we'll book you a flight tomorrow. But you make the choice after one day on the beach. Sat on the beach, contemplated it through, and said, no, I'm going to stick this thing through. I'm going to stick it out. From there on in, I didn't lose another match. I won the three tournaments in a row in singles and doubles. And then that gave me the confidence and belief to push through. But you see the unity of the team. Everybody from the psychologist, coach, physical trainer, and my dad all had the same message to me. They were in unity. No, you stick it out. This is a hiccup in the road. This is not thinking correctly mentally. And if you're not going to push through, you'll never know. So the message was clear from the team. They knew exactly what to say, and they still let it be my choice.
Small margins.
There's more to that story as well, but it's those moments where you think to yourself, you know, I have a choice. I can either continue or I don't. And you've got to reflect on the hours, and everybody can have a bad day at the office, and you think you should run through something easily. If it was that easy, we'd all make it in sport or finance or business or whatever it is. But I think having a good team of people that understand and that can send you the right messages when you need it is so crucial. I mean, look at Novak Djokovic, the GOAT of all time in our sport of tennis. Still had Andy Murray trying to get better. He still has somebody there. What are you going to tell to a guy who's won 24 majors, done everything? It's messaging. It's keeping them going. It's finding solutions. It's trying to get better no matter what. And if you do and you stick with it long enough, you usually get what you want out of it.
What's the more to that story?
Oh, the more was I went to sleep for like 17 hours because I was jet lagged, living in a nice youth hostel, one toilet, one shower. You open the windows, there was a brick wall. It wasn't glamorous. And then good omen for me, nobody died, thank goodness, was that the youth hostel burnt down 3 days later after the tournament over. So it was like almost like something in the past that's never happened again. I'm not going to not believe in myself. So I had a lot going on that first week of being professional.
I actually had a question here. What actually happens when you turn pro? But you've just answered it. The hostel burns down. Dad saves my career.
Yeah.
Do you think if he hadn't have said that, if it was just you and your dad on the phone, do you think you would have finished up?
Well, I think my dad understood me. So like when I hear people or federations or people saying parents aren't important on the journey, there's nobody who knows you better than your parents. And you've got to include them in the journey, and you've got to, you don't have to agree with them all the time, but you have to make them still part of that child or player's life in a manner that is constructive. And remember, there's a reason why they've achieved what they've achieved. And I think my father was smart enough that if I got the same messaging from everybody, that I wouldn't come home, but he still left it up to me as my choice.
He knew you was making an emotional decision rather than having that little bit of time to think about it. He probably knew deep down that you was going to stick it out and you just needed that day.
Well, he did, but you've got to imagine as a 18-year-old kid by yourself, traveling week to week, and also going to Israel during the Gulf War, it's a culture shock. You walk off the plane, you have kids your age, 18, with machine guns and handguns and in the military service, you're taking a bus from the airport because you don't have enough money to take a taxi. So you're thinking, okay, this is really odd. And then you lose to some local kids and you're thinking, oh my God, what the hell am I doing? And that's the reality is you're going to have a moment no matter what you do where you have that doubt in yourself. Mm. It's finding that solution and having, that's why I say team and people and parents are so, so crucial.
Was that your first trip abroad?
No, I'd been to Florida and America to play. So from about 15, I had my first ATP point. Mm. So I was already ranked in the world, but I hadn't traveled into the Middle East. So what most people do when they turn pro to get easy points, they go to India, they go somewhere a little bit more adventurous because they're hoping to chase the ladder unless they're really feted like a Nadal or like an Alcaraz where they can skip some of the steps.
So you're chasing points, are you, to try and get your rankings up as easily as possible?
So there's three levels of professional tennis. It's called the Futures now, which used to be satellites during my day, challenger level, which is the mid level, and then the pro tour. So the bottom level, you need to get out as quickly as you can because you can get there stuck for a long time. Then you want to jump to the challenger level. Then you want to go to the pro level where you're near in the top 100 in the world. The longer it takes you to get out of each level, the less chance you have of making it.
No easy segue for this one, but let's go with it.
Okay.
During your career, you won 30 singles matches for Great Britain.
Yep.
You won your first and last between the years of 1995 and 2007. 2003, yep. You were set to represent GB once again.
Yep.
And you've talked about this, of course, Greg. Soon after doing a press conference, you were informed that you'd been tested positive for the steroid nandrolone. Am I getting that right?
Yep, that's correct.
What followed was a saga that involved many months and many players before you were eventually acquitted. Can you tell us how this period made you feel, one that you described as any athlete's worst nightmare?
Well, I think everybody knows that it's 100% liability. And I actually write about this in my book, this whole segment. And I think the system at times is against the athlete because at that period, almost every player in the top 100 in the world had the same fingerprint and it not tested positive because they were below the levels. I think it was something like 47 out of the top 120 players had the exact same fingerprint without testing positive. And so at the time, I had what was equivalent to a grain of salt in Wembley in my system. And they said, you cannot create any nandrolone in your body whatsoever. You can't get it through food. You can't get it through other things, which we know is false now. So they have something called active urine, which they wrote about to me 2 years later, which was basically if you're in hot weather and there's energy. And the CEO wrote to me 2 years later after the case and said, we're changing the levels because of that aspect. Then we found out if you eat pork or meat, red meat, you can test positive for nandrolone. And the amount I had in my body was so, so little. And for me, it was a period that was so difficult because of the injustice. They had the choice at the time because they had other cases and they still had people testing positive under those levels to go through that whole situation. So for me, it was a very, very difficult period because I knew I'd done nothing wrong. I tested every single product I have, tested every single batch number. And the only thing it could be is the electrolytes that the ATP had given me. And they didn't even give me the name of the company until the later stages of my case. So I couldn't even check it out if it was the electrolyte company that they'd been given all the players. So it was such a difficult period for me to go through. And we've heard about cases now with the world number ones of Cabal and Faro who ate meat in Colombia and tested positive for it. So the science at the time was not correct. And I had still had the 100% liability. So for me, I stand up for players when they come into those difficult situations. And it's still something that kind of angers me having to go through it publicly as well.
Did you ever get drug tested, Luke?
Yeah, all the time. We had it a lot. And also, if you missed a day of training, you had to message the drug testers where you would be for 1 hour of that day. But it's really easy to forget to do that. And people did do that. If you got 3 strikes that season, then you could find yourself in big trouble. But going back to Greg there, this is a man that turned down a steroid going into, you know, the finals of the US Open. Mm. So his history says that the last thing he wants to do is do anything into question.
I mean, for me, it's like I write about it in my book, so I go into a lot more detail on the science and how it works and the timing during that. They actually had an East German doctor who wrote an article saying, I can show that's a natural occurrence, those amounts in the body, and you can get it from food. Nobody at that time believed you could get the contamination from eating at a steakhouse in America. Because if you shoot up the cattle with that steroid, that's how it gets into your system. We saw that with Cabal and Farah. We saw that with Tara Moore. We saw that with multiple athletes in the future. So that's where I think they're trying to make sure that everything is regulated, but there sometimes has to be common sense on the issues as well.
I read an article from The Guardian back in that time. I'm just going to read you a little bit from it. Crucially for Rozetsky, the saga concluded in March with his acquittal and the restoration of a reputation that some critics appeared to relish consigning to the dustbin. Who were these critics and why did they exist, Greg?
I think it just makes good headlines at times. I don't know if there are that many critics. I think I had a lot of support from a lot of players on the tour. I remember Andre Agassi saying to me, I wish you the best of luck, you know, really stood behind me in this situation. And for me, I feel like any athlete who has to go through this situation and they know they're innocent and they know they've done nothing wrong, it is one of the most difficult things to deal with. And that's where I think there has to be some sort of help for players who don't financially or aren't financially able to handle it. So my case even had the fascinating bit that I had this guy called Mark Gay who would only prosecute. He prosecuted Dwight Chambers. He prosecuted multiple cases and never defended. He read my case and he said, this is ridiculous. This should be thrown out. You shouldn't even have to get on the airplane for this. The QC at the time, who'd be a KC right now, David Panic representing me. So I was lucky that I was in a financial situation where I could afford to defend myself. When I showed up to the case, they had six lawyers, like 3 to 6 people there, I think three lawyers extra, had basically lawyered up to try to say it was nothing to do with them and it was all to do with me. So that whole situation, imagine if you don't have that financial needs. That's where the player union, they've had a lot of discussions about of having player union to represent lesser players who can't afford to invest that in the defense they need to clear their name.
I just think that it's disappointing when that happens because no matter what now, your name is still tarnished with this incident a little bit, even though you're acquitted at the end of it.
I don't think my name is tarnished, if I'm going to be frank with you. I think what hurts is if kids will go on Google to your kids and read that without understanding
That's
the facts
what I mean,
of the situation.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't feel it tarnished me at all because I've been very fortunate to work in the media. So the day I retired, I worked for Sky, I've worked for BBC, I've worked for Amazon. So I think acquitting and winning that case was so important. Does it change any perspective? I don't really think so. You know, and I'm quite tough. As a sports man or a sports woman, you know you have to have that fortitude to push forward and you know what the truth of the situation is. And if you have that strength and inner belief in yourself that you know what's right, you know what's wrong, you know whether you did anything or you didn't, and I know 100% I have never taken an illegal drug to play sport.
What was the hardest part, though?
For me, I've always been where I don't overly worry what people think about me. Only the people I care about think about me. So for them, I think it's harder for the people around you than it is for you. I think the injustice is what really, really bothered me. I think getting your name out there in a situation and having to prove your innocence, I think, is the most important thing. And, you know, I've spoken to other people who've been in a similar situation to try to help them out. And just explain to them how the system works and what they can do and get the right people because there are some injustices happening because of the way the system is at times.
Did you sympathize at all with Yannick Sinner's case?
Yannick Sinner's case, I think, I don't know the truth of the matter. What I find unbelievable about the situation is for him to test positive in Miami and then to test positive afterwards in Indian Wells. And I think the due process is what a lot of people on tour are concerned about because he had his brief and answered the question in less than 5 hours. That is record time. Mm. Without being forewarned about it, it's almost unheard of to be able to defend because you've got to test all your products. You've got to know what products are being put on you with a cream. To have a physio that's rubbing you with a cut hand to get it into your system. It's like you have all these question marks. Then he wins his case originally, which is great. So they've gone due diligence. Then WADA steps in, I believe, and sends it to the court of arbitration. They send it to the court of arbitration, and the penalties are two things, 0 or 1 to 2 year ban. If he's innocent, it should be 0. They come to an arrangement where after he wins the Australian Open, it's 3 months, and to the date, he comes back in the Italian Open for his first tournament. So I think the process is the question mark. And then the other question you've got to ask yourself is, okay, there were 38 Italian athletes with the exact same substance in their body, I think, over the last 3 years, if it is correct from all the reading I've done into this case. So the only people that would know would be Yannick and the team around him. And I don't know about you, but I don't know how many physios have rubbed you with a cut on their hand and have a product in their bag that has a banned list on it. So there's question marks on that situation. But the truth of the matter, the only person who knows is Yannick and his team around him. But I think the process is the big question mark for everybody.
What did you learn about yourself during that time?
I think it's about resilience and which people really stick behind you. Know who your friends are, the ones who get on the telephone calls and who are there for you. And so that's your core group. The ones that don't, usually you know where they stand. I said that would probably be the most important lesson. And the nice thing is I got justice at the end, meaning I cleared my name. Financially, there was no recourse financially to be able to get compensation for the situation. And that still niggles me to this date. But to clear your name, to go through that situation, you're not going to go through anything harder as an athlete.
Do you talk about that with anyone now?
The only time I think I thought about it a little bit more, because we had another British girl by the name of Tara Moore who had eaten beef in Colombia, and they were getting her where she got overturned, then she got re-banned and all these situations. And I'm like, the onus of duty on her to find the cattle in Colombia where she ate the beef in the marketplace, it's very difficult to do. So everybody knows now that you shouldn't be eating meat in Colombia, but I don't think there was an intention to cheat. And that's where it has to be. Because imagine you go out for a steak dinner and you're a professional athlete. You're thinking your food you're going to eat should be fine. You're not thinking, oh my God, I can't eat this or that because something terrible could happen to me and I could lose my career or I'd have to go through this terrible situation.
You retired in 2007.
Yep.
But you thought about coming back.
Yep.
So our Luke over here, he was ready to retire. He had some bad hips.
I couldn't wait to walk off into the sunset. Yeah, you wanted to go back for more.
Well, no, I just wanted to go back to help the doubles team in the Davis Cup.
Yeah.
So like when I was near the end of my career, a certain guy by the name of Andy Murray showed up. Not a bad player. And he played his first Davis Cup in Israel in Tel Aviv, of all places. And I knew there was something special about this kid. And I thought it was more to help out in a Davis Cup team, to help out playing a little bit of doubles. It wasn't to play singles or to go full-time back on the tour. And when the captain and the team realized they didn't want that to happen, and I was still playing on the Champions Tour, which means I was still playing regularly. I was still practicing. I was still in good shape. I was thinking, maybe I can be a little bit of help there. But the captain nor the team around it wanted, so it was easy to re-retire.
You and Andy, dream team.
Well, I think we had the best Davis Cup team when I retired, apart from the winning team in 2015 with Andy and his brother and the rest of the team who did a fantastic job to win. I think I looked at it was when I retired in 07, my final match, I was playing doubles with Jamie Murray, who was number one at the time. Then we had Andy and Tim playing singles. So the four of us wasn't a bad combination to go out and retire in.
I always say, people ask me like, who's your favorite interview? And obviously I say Greg, but second to Greg, Andy Murray, we had a 40-minute delay because there was a sound issue. And he spent that entire time just talking to the crew, asking them about their families. And I think in so many instances, the athlete or the guest there would have probably left. And then when he was crying on court, what do you think that did for, I think, male sports people particularly? What did it show them?
Well, it shows he's being authentic and he's being himself. You know, I think he kind of, I remember when Andy was put to the press with Tim, and there was a whole England-Scotland football going on at the period. And they had a table, and it was basically one of those tables where getting to know somebody, it's kind of off the record, on the record sort of thing. And he was young. And any Scotsman would say, yeah, I'm going to take Scotland over England. It's a normal statement. There's not a Scottish man who's going to say, no, I'm going for England. That's the reality of it in football. And the press headlines went that way. And then he got a little bit defensive in that situation because they kind of threw him a little bit under the bus, if I was going to be quite frank about that situation. And I think so he had his barrier up. And his big turning point was 2012 to become a great of the game and the best British male tennis player in the Open era, because he cried in that finals he lost to Federer. You know, he said, I can cry like Roger, but I can't beat Roger or play like Roger when he lost that final. And then the public said, oh, he's got emotion. He's a nice guy. We like him. And then he went on to 2012 to win the Olympic gold medal, beat Federer. Something Federer has never done is win a gold medal in his career at the Olympics in singles. And that propelled him to going on to win the US Open and then going on to win Wimbledon afterwards. So being his authentic self, being comfortable was huge for him. And I think that's why he's achieved his success, because super driven, worked super hard, and was his authentic self of who he really was and showed us what a great champion he is.
Which you can't really do in football. You can't really be yourself.
Not really. And every individual deals with it differently. But I never used to say a word to anybody if he was feeling any kind of insecurities. You just wouldn't say it in that kind of team environment.
You'd be in a football match and you'd lose a tough match. There's no press in the locker room. They're getting kicked out. And sometimes you might have an emotional let out, whether it's yelling, screaming, crying, whatever it is. But you can actually do it more in private. You know, in the ceremony, it's a little bit different. And I think usually the players I respect the most from the past or the present are the ones who don't really care and give you that honest truth. And I think, you know, Murray's done that exceptionally well throughout his career. I think Rafa's done it exceptionally well. And they've got a confidence that they're happy to say what they really mean than rather always saying the right thing, I would say. And that's always much more interesting when you get into the journalistic field.
What are you most proud of that tennis fans might not be aware of?
I think probably my family. I think for me, I retired when my daughter was 1 year old and I could have kept on going a little bit longer. And I decided family was more important with my kids and taking care of my kids and trying to be a good father. It's not always easy. And that to me is important because let's be realistic. I did for a living before I became more into journalism and all these other things. I had a yellow ball over the net one more time than my opponent. I remember this story. I met Fred Perry when I was like 15 in Montreal. And I said, what's the secret? He said, hit the ball in the court one more time than your opponent over the net. And I said to Bjorn Borg when I was 17 playing his exhibition when he's coming back. And he said the same thing to me. And I'm like, really? That's it? Can I get more information, please? So these are kind of the memories and the stories you have. And let's be honest, I'm not saving anybody, but I'm giving people a little bit of entertainment. That's what sport is for people. It's a passion. It's an entertainment. It's an escapism. And in football, it's sometimes like a religion for people, especially their country or their sporting team.
Mentioned a lot of legends there. Do you have a go-to story without spoiling the book, Greg? Without spoiling the book.
Okay, I better get this book out now because I've been writing it myself. I'm about 45,000 words in, so I got to get the finishing touches. You pick a player you'd like a story on.
Federer.
Okay, so Roger.
Come on.
So when I saw Roger the first time, he was working with Peter Carter and Peter Lundgren, and my coach at the time was Sven Grunewald, who worked for the Swiss Tennis Federation. He said, yeah, watch out for this kid. He's going to be unbelievable, this kid, Roger Federer. So I played him in Vienna the first time. He's like 19 years old, and I crunched the guy 4-4, and I'm thinking, this guy's not all that good. He's got a terrible attitude on the court. He's complaining about my serve not being able to return. I'm thinking, what's the hype about this kid? And all of a sudden, he figures it out because there's a tragedy with Peter Carter, his coach at the time, who unfortunately died in a car crash in South Africa. And then he figured out how this game worked and what it takes to become a legend. And I didn't really spot him. If you would have said to me, Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, I would have said Federer is not the one who's going to really make it because of the attitude, the grind, and what it took. But certain incidents in your life really give you that impetus. And if you look at people who achieve incredible things and become legends of our sport or any sport, they've had some sort of tragedy happen in their life that's propelled them there. And he figured it out at 23, and then he became an absolute dominant force in the sport. So I think one story which I take with all greats, there's something that's happened to them. Murray was Dunblane, which he doesn't like to talk about. Federer was what happened with Peter Carter. Rafa, I don't know what it is, but I know he had a huge influence from his uncle Tony of standards and family values that really propelled him. So for me, the Federer story is I didn't think he was that good and he became unbelievably great. So sometimes we get it wrong.
What was the hardest thing you had to overcome?
Well, I think the hardest things that I always like to say we had to overcome, because it's not just me, it's my family, it's the team around me, is finding a way to make this happen. Because it's not like football where you can get dropped off at a club. You need a parent to push you through it that's willing to believe in you enough and willing to risk everything. So it not necessarily what I did. I'd say it's what the people around me did with me to achieve. Without them, forget it, it would have never happened.
And I think it's great that you recognize the impact that your family and the sacrifice that they had to make to help you on your road. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make it without it, with either, especially tennis, his family's huge, and finding it, it's not easy. And if you don't have that, it doesn't matter what you're doing in life. And you need people that are role models, people that basically believe in you and people that are willing to do it. And you also have to work exceptionally hard, but you have to work smart at the same time. Because if you don't do that and you don't have the right people, it's almost impossible to succeed.
We've had Alex de Minaur on UTS a lot. He said after Turin this year, he lost to Musetti. He eventually qualified for the semifinals, but he said, I could have told you at that point, I hated tennis. And he was talking about balancing his schedule next season because he doesn't want to get into those moments where the spirals, where it becomes too much.
Yeah.
So if a player is struggling, I guess, silently right now, it sounds like you have some good advice. What would you say?
Well, I think if they're spiraling, is to take a little bit of a break, reflect, and why are you doing this? What got you into this game? You've got to find your love of the game. And also something Darren Cahill, who's considered, in my opinion, the best coach in tennis, he said, it's still got to be fun. If you're not having fun, why are you going to put in that grind and those hours? Is it only about winning? It's not the process and you're not having fun. And if you don't have those things, you're not going to work as hard and you're not going to achieve what you want. If it becomes monotonous and repetitive and you're tired, it's better to take a step back, get the fun back, then get the work in, and then get the process. And it's like most of us, we're always look, what's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? And we don't celebrate things enough. And that is one of the issues. And Alex has been super impressive this year. To me, he's been one of the most improved players. He's done brilliantly well, and he's an absolute maximizer. So find that love and passion back. And he's got a great team. I mean, how many people can say the guy who coaches him coached him from like when he started out all the way to top 10 in the world? It's an amazing story in itself.
This is our last episode before Christmas. Let's build your ultimate tennis player, and we're going to start with forehand.
Rafael Nadal, anytime. I practiced with him once, and once he got that forehand going, you were second best.
How was the practice?
The practice was great. I didn't allow him to hit a ground stroke. Serve and volleyed every point, chipped and charged. But once we got in the rally, it was a zero-sum game.
Was it on clay?
No, it was indoors in Toulouse when he was about 19 years old. And I remember the first time I ever saw Rafa was as a 15-year-old at an exhibition in Mallorca. I was supposed to meet him in the second round, and I was playing Guillermo Canas. I've never been so happy to lose a match in my life because this 15-year-old, I watch him practice with his agent, Carlos Costa, who was a former top tenor. And I sat there for an hour with my mouth wide open thinking, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this in my life, and I don't want anything to do with this on a clay court.
15.
Yeah, he was like Alcaraz when he showed up. It's just like a freak of nature. It's just something you just say to yourself, oh my God, I've never seen anything so good in my life. I guess it's like when Wayne Rooney showed up all of a sudden as a 16-year-old, you know, at Everton, and then all of a sudden moved to Man United. It's a similar thing. You just see greatness right away.
Who was the football equivalent for you?
Michael Owen, same age category as me, but he just skipped all of the England age group. So he went from sort of under 18 straight into the full international squad. And people don't look back at his career in the kind of two phases, like one where he was kind of wasn't happy with his hamstrings and stuff like that. But if you look at 3 or 4 year period, he was incredible, untouchable.
Backhand.
Backhand, I would go between Sinner and Djokovic, and I'm going to go with Sinner just because of the speed he can create. I describe Sinner as Novak 2.0. This guy is just ridiculous. Because of his skiing days, he can slide into the core, that backhand corner, and just generate so much pace. And also being so tall with his athleticism, he's just taking it up a level.
Serve?
Pete Sampras, greatest of all time. I don't care what anybody says, even better than anybody in this generation. Second serve was 118. You knew exactly where it was going. It was always hitting the line. Greatest serve that ever existed in our sport.
And then you, right?
No, let's not be too kind. I was a mirror image of Goran Ivanisevic, but he had a little bit better serve than me, but that was one of my strengths.
Touch,
John McEnroe. I think unbelievable feel. That's what got me into tennis, was watching him. I loved the way he argued with the chair umpires, his passion, his genius, his feel around the court, And we need a bad boy that wins like him in this generation.
I think you get reprimanded a lot quicker nowadays in most of the sports. So you find yourself missing games or being thrown out of tournaments and stuff like that. So you can't do it.
I think it also has to do with the corporate. So like in tennis right now, everybody says, I like everybody. This is great. That's great. Because there's so much money in sport. That generation with the tennis players in the 1980s, they were on the front covers of all the magazines. They're going out to nightclubs the first week of Wimbledon, having a good time. They didn't have to get right from the start and the get-go. And with social media and everything around now, they don't want that extra pressure.
This is maybe a good time to ask you about Nick Kyrgios then, because I think he is still one of those players. How do you feel about the Battle of the Sexes match between him and Aryna Sabalenka?
Well, we actually, our next podcast, which I'm going to plug here on
Please
your show,
do.
Obviously.
Shameless plug.
Yes, of course. Off Court with Greg, which I'm with the tennis mentor, Ashley Neves, and 365 journalist, Kevin Palmer. We talked about that Battle of the Sexes, and our opinion about that is, I feel it's very gimmicky. Because the Battle of the Sexes, you got to remember, with Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, was Bobby Riggs had beaten the world number one Margaret Court, like 2-2 in a matchup. And then all of a sudden, Billie Jean had trained so hard for this. They played on the same dimensional court, two serves, and it was in the Astrodome, I think something like 70 to 100,000 people watching. And Billie Jean won that match, and that went on for women's prize money to become equal with men's. The Virginia Slims Tour was created, and all those things happened. This one's a gimmick. Different court size, one serve. It doesn't have that same feel as that past one.
If you had one current male player now, one female player, who would you pit against each other?
Well,
that would mean it wasn't a gimmick.
Well, I think Sabalenka, you've got the world number one.
Yeah.
So right there, there's no question. You want the best player on the planet. But then the question is, which male player do you take? And it's really difficult because in the past, you had Martina offered, I believe Martina Navratilova was offered $1 million years ago when she was number one to do, but didn't do it. And it's really difficult. I guess Kyrgios kind of fits the mold because he's the bad boy tennis, but he hasn't been playing full-time tennis for 3 years. I think for tennis, the reason they went to the one serve and did that was because they want to speed up the game. So Patrick Mortoglou, who's done the UTS, which we were at in London.
Shout out UTS.
Yes, exactly. He did that because he wanted to get the younger generation, younger fan in. I mean, if you have kids, you understand it's like, the phone is glued to their head and it drives me nuts. And their attention span is very short. Anything you want, you press Amazon, you press Uber Eats, whatever you want, it's instantaneous. So I think people's attention span isn't what it used to be. And sometimes you need to make changes in sports to allow people to have that instantaneous feel or to bring a younger generation.
Let's rattle through these last four. So strategy, who would you pick?
I think Murray's up there with strategy. I think he does exceptionally well with dissecting players because I remember speaking to Judy when he was like 12 or 13. He dissected how he was going to beat Murat Safin at the time, who was world number one. So I think Murray doesn't get enough credit. What a brilliant strategist he is. And I think that's one of the reasons also Novak took him at the beginning of this year.
So Andy was plotting world domination from a young age.
He was. I have to give him a lot of credit. He reads players exceptionally well, and that's something you have to do.
We've also got mindset.
Oh, wow. Novak Djokovic. The mindset is outrageously good. I've had a chip on my shoulder. Novak's had a chip on his shoulder, and that's been the driver because his question mark was always, why is Federer and Nadal getting all the attention? What about me? And this is the guy who finds solution no matter what he does. You look at what he did when Federer and Nadal were ahead of him. He went into diet because remember, he was losing air. He wasn't being able to finish matches. So he just let no stone unturned. And that's what makes him such a genius.
Raw talent.
McEnroe when I was growing up, Agassi, and this generation, raw talent. Well, probably between Nick Kyrgios and Carlos Alcaraz. So when Nick was playing Nick, because I saw him as a 17-year-old and I was like, oh my God, Nike, you got to sign him. A week later, he beat Nadal at Wimbledon. But if a raw talent that's playing consistently, Carlos Alcaraz.
And last one, style, the most important, Greg.
Oh, style, Federer, no question. I mean, it looks so easy, but it's not easy. He just makes it look that way. It's so elegant. There's not really anything that's not beautiful in this game. I couldn't be more opposite.
What's Christmas like for a footballer compared to a tennis player?
Yeah, it's always the one time where you realise that you're not going to spend a lovely Christmas, especially you'd go in training, you know, sometimes on Christmas Day and things like that. You have the match on Boxing Day. So this was the toughest period where you're away a lot, actually. There was quite a lot of games they'd cram in around the Christmas period. So you didn't really get much time to spend with your family and really enjoy many Christmases. So obviously a perk of retiring was you got to enjoy it.
Whereas you have a quote-unquote off-season.
Yeah, off-season isn't off. You're training in the off-season to be ready for the new season. So I think most of the players, you know, if they don't make the end-of-season championships with top eight, get maybe 1 or 2 weeks off, and then the grind starts up. Christmas, for me, when I was a player, was I'd always go for a run in the morning, do my exercise, and then get ready for Christmas Day. And training just didn't stop. You're on the merry-go-round 365. If you're Federer, you didn't have to go on the merry-go-round quite as much. You still had to do all the hard work, but your merry-go-round was 12 tournaments a year because you're winning seven of them. Makes life a lot easier when you're winning all the time.
You've lived the full experience, the highs, the lows, the scrutiny, the comebacks.
Yep.
When you strip everything away, rankings, wins, losses, what did tennis ultimately give you?
Well, I think it gave me a belief. Actually, I'd say it gave me a belief, but I actually did what I wanted to do in life. I always wanted to be a tennis player. That was the only thing I ever thought about. So for me, I was actually lucky enough to do what I wanted to do. Most people don't get to do that. I think I got to see a lot of the world, which I would have never visited had I not been a professional tennis player. You know, I've been to Israel, I've been to Guam, I've been to Hong Kong, I've been to Tokyo. I've been to most places around the world people only dream about going to visit in their life. It's given me an interesting cross-section of friends and people I've met. I mean, presidents, prime ministers. It's just given me just a different perspective of life. So I've been very blessed. I've been very fortunate. It also gives you challenges in life because your career is all of a sudden finished at 32, 33, and you got to figure out what the heck left do I do with the rest of my life, which is every sportsman or sportswoman's thing. And, you know, I was lucky I've been in the being able to talk about sport and waffle on about it for a few decades now and continuing to do so as well.
You're very good at talking, which is good for us. We enjoyed it. One last shameless plug for the podcast, yeah. Off Court with Greg. What did you like off court, Greg?
What am I like off court?
Yeah.
Well, we did our first podcast on court, but off court, I'm absolutely fine. So Off Court with Greg, if you want to follow us, we're on Spotify, YouTube, Apple, all the platforms. It's with Ashley Neves, the tennis mentor, and Kevin Palmer from Tennis 365. If you love your tennis, we're going to have a mixture of guests from people in tennis and people outside of tennis as well. So give us a listen and hopefully you like it. And if you have any critiques about us, please, we take any sort of feedback.
We'll give it a review. You want to play him at tennis now?
I wouldn't mind having a little go. Yeah, I'll just target his backhand, and I don't. Apparently, that's the way forward.
It's so much better now. I've changed strings. I come over because I'm relaxed about it.
How fast is the serve now?
I played at the Legends at Wimbledon with Conchita, so I think I got up to 125.
It's not bad.
So it's all right. It still goes, but not what it used to be.
Make sure you check out Greg's new podcast. Give us both a collective. It would be 10 stars, wouldn't it? 5-star review each.
I don't mind if I don't get a 5-star. There's only one way to improve. I want an honest opinion. Just give us honesty is the best policy.
Thank you for being honest with us, Greg. Appreciate your time. And we'll see you after Christmas. We'll be back in 2026. Looking forward to it.